This is Betty Turnell with the Oral History, sponsored by the Decatur Public Library. And our guest today is Mr. R.E. Burkett, Vice President and Assistant to the Chairman of Archer Daniels Midland Company of Decatur, Illinois. Welcome to our series, Mr. Burkett. We are recording on June 10, 1987 at 254 East Pearson Avenue in Decatur. Mr. Burkett, what is the history of Archer Daniels Midland?
Late in the 19th century, both the Archer and Daniels family separately were engaged in the linseed processing business in the Miami Valley area of Ohio. As other crops became more important in that part of the country, the production of flax and or linseed moved westward. And by early in the 20th century, the Minnesota-Dakota areas was the largest producer of flax in the U.S. So in 1902, the Daniels family started what was called the Daniels Linseed Company. And that is what we consider the forerunner and the origination of what is today ADM. Then by 1914, the Daniels Company merged with another company that had been established, which was the Archer Linseed Company, to form the Archer Daniels Linseed Company. By 1923, there was another linseed processor in that area named the Midland for a geographical location, not a family name. And that 1923 then is when Archer Daniels Midland came into being as an oil seed processing company dealing mainly in flax seed.
Were these oils for human consumption?
No, these were more industrial oils for rosins, drying, paints, and so forth. Back when linseed paints were very popular, today you hardly see any because they're all latex-based. Mm-hmm. But linseed oil was the largest source, or most drying oils, resins, and paints had linseed oil in them.
And it was a plant, linseed plant?
Yes, it's grown, it's commonly called flax, sometimes called linseed, depending upon what part of the country you're from. But it's a flax plant that has a tiny seed that is about 20% oil content.
So that explains the origin of the company.
Right, and our first and today our largest business is oil seed processing.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have changed the source of the oil, though, have you not?
Of course, right after World War II, soybeans became much more prominent because the oil there was a good edible oil, and the soybean meal was a better meal in the as far as nutrition goes for animal feeding, especially for poultry, better balance of amino acids. So the meal and oil demand following World War II in the late 40s and 50s pretty well ended. The flax is a much less important crop today than it was then, and beans are tremendously more important today than they were in the 50s.
Do you still have the field of industrial oils, or do you
still
have to change
to the still process linseed at one of our plants up in Minnesota, Red Wing, Minnesota, is the only plant where we process linseed, where we have 19 domestic plants for soybean processing and 4 overseas plants.
Well, good. Are we ready to come to Decatur?
Absolutely.
How did we get here?
Right after World War II, ADM got into some other businesses. That was the vogue to diversify, and we got into the fiberglass boat business. We got in big in the chemical business and put a lot of money in chemical plants. They didn't have the expertise to run it. Those divisions weren't doing well. So the Archer and Daniels families came to Mr. Andreas and his brother and asked if the Andreases would join the company and kind of redirect it back to what everyone knows best, and that is agricultural processing. Forget the chemicals, etc. Mr. Andreas said, sure, that was his. He'd been in the business with his father from childhood in processing and feed business, grain business, etc. He said, yes, he would, but he thought that the company had to be pared down from where it was. It had gotten quite large and in some of the superfluous type areas of PR, advertising, etc., and felt that the officers and operators should be closer to the businesses. At that time, our Decatur soybean plant, we there were two, the East and the West plants, largest concentration of processing that we had in the bean business, said, let's put our headquarters down there in Decatur where the people look out the window and see what they're doing and know that this is our basic business, oilseed processing, and we forget about chemicals and things. He came in, sold off the chemical division, the boat division, et cetera, moved the corporate headquarters from Minneapolis down to Decatur in 1969 to get the feel for the processing business and locate the office, just like Gus Daly did when he put his office overlooking his plants.
Had Mr. Andreas been associated with Decatur from the beginning?
No. A company he had, First Interoceanic, purchased what is now the Decatur West plant, which was the old plant that was put up by Spencer Kellogg. His holding company had purchased that in the 60s, but he himself had no association other than the fact, tell a little story if I may, that he said the reason that his family got into the oilseed processing business was they were in the feed business. He used to buy his annual contract for soybean meal, which is the protein source for these animal feeds, over here in Decatur from the Staley Company. Then they'd be shipped by rail over to Cedar Rapids, Iowa, where his family had their little feed mixing business. And he came over one year to buy his annual contract and met with Mr. Staley Sr. No, I'm sorry, this was Gus Staley. And Mr. Staley told Mr. Andreas at that time, he said, you know, I wanted to build a plant, a Staley bean plant over in Iowa, because the Iowa farmers are growing more beans now. But my directors think we should go ahead and concentrate in this one plant here in Decatur, and they'd rather expand Decatur than build a plant over there in Iowa where there's a new demand, a new supply of beans. He said, somebody should do that. And Duane said, well, how would you go about it? And Mr. Staley said, all you got to do is go over to the equipment people in Ohio that are making the processing equipment, the extractors and the grinders and the rollers, and they'll probably finance you because they're so anxious to sell equipment. If you've got a good credit record, a good business record, they'll finance you. So Duane went back, and he was about 22 years old at this time, told his dad what Mr. Staley had said. They thought about it. They felt they were going to grow. So they went over to the equipment people in Ohio and said, Mr. Staley said we should put up our own plant. And they said, we'll finance you. And that's really how Duane first got in, because Mr. Staley recommended to him that he do so.
And isn't it interesting that instead of competition between the firms, they were cooperating?
Cooperating even back then. Staley, as you may know, was in the bean business for a while. We actually end up buying all of their properties, and they're out of the bean business now, but still in the corn business. And we ended up with all the Staley properties. But we're friendly competitors in the corn business. But even though they've left Decatur for headquarters and all, there's still a good association there.
Well, how did Decatur happen to be such a center for soybeans?
The U of I, of course, was doing some work, and this was one of the reasons. And some of the seed companies, and including some of the old seed companies with Decatur ties, were doing some of the early work in soybean development. One of the needs was that after World War I, all this land that had been producing corn wasn't that much of a demand. The farmers wanted to find a new crop that could be looked at as a cash crop. The bean people had been working along, found out that this was a good area for growing beans. We find out now, or we know now, that beans require almost equal amounts of darkness and light, and so they grow best in latitudes that have more or less even days and nights. For example, they won't grow too far north like Canada because there's too much light. They won't grow, there's not enough, they won't grow too far south where there's too much. They almost want equal amounts. This is a good latitude for it. The U of I had good research and we had good seed companies. They developed the beans that by the time World War II came along and we were cut off from some of our overseas supplies of fats and oils, the bean just took off then.
So all circumstances work together to bring this business to Decatur. Well, that is a fascinating story.
One other reason that Decatur grew to be a center was it was excellent location as far as transportation goes. The old Wabash and the nickel plate and all that came through here, a good rail center. for a long, long time, and I can't really tell you when it stopped, but certainly from the 30s on, and I think it existed through the late 70s, everything that was sold as far as soybean meal or soybean oil, the products produced, was based FOB Decatur. And the Chicago Board of Trade contracts were all priced FOB, and if you took delivery, then you'd have to back freight off from that. But just like steel used to be FOB Pittsburgh, for many, many years, all soybean products were FOB Decatur, and it was known all across the country as the soybean capital of the world.
Very good. Well, now, could we talk about the interest in diet and food? Are we ready to, or perhaps we should talk a little more about soybeans first, the problems and successes that you have encountered in your experiments with soybeans?
You know, I think we've had good progress and good results in our experiments. The marketing has always been a disappointment, and maybe it's because soybeans are not that well known in this part of the world, but we're over in China and Japan, people drink soy milk, the tofu and so forth, have for centuries. We're just starting, but our own experience started out with research done in 1933. We had a laboratory set up in Chicago where we had that WEADM had a plant set up in Chicago that in the late 30s, the four companies that were involved, this by this time is say 38, 39, and that would have been Spencer Kellogg, Central Soya, Staley, and ADM, jointly worked a research project using soy flour in bread, in which they proved that you could bake very good bread and increase the nutrition because the amino acid balance, real quickly the wheat is deficient in lysine, and soy is not deficient, but is low in methionine. But each has the amino acid the other is lacking. You put the two together, and you double the nutritional value of the protein in that bread. Small combination. It was fed in the state of Illinois in the prison system, pre-World War II, and proved out that to be nutrition. But then World War II came along, and all the soy went into feeding programs in relief. The countries we were in, we bought soy in. Marshall Plan was full of soy products and all. Probably too full, because once people got back on their feet, they resented the fact that they had to eat soy burgers and heavily soy flours and so forth, and said no more of that soy. We've improved the products tremendously since those days, the quality of product is better appearing, the taste levels are reduced so it's more appetizing, etc. But for years we've been laboring under bringing back, reducing that image. We have trouble today when we go to some parts of Europe to introduce soy proteins. They said, my mother or the older people themselves will say, we had that under the Marshall Plan and we like to eat real meat or real things now. The industry, so then kind of zeroed into the health food people who were concerned with nutrition because you could get protein without cholesterol like you would from meat, or you could get a mix of things. You could blend things together well, functionality, and then you had the tofus start to come along. We can make all from soy. These products are growing in use as far as the actual protein goes. The oils, the oil side, very popular now, as you will remember, and I do. Butter was the thing. We had trouble getting the lettuce put color in margarine. As late as the time we came to Decatur, and that's, we'll say, the early 70s, the state of Minnesota that we left still did not permit colored margarine. And when people from Decatur would go, quote, back home to Minnesota for the holidays, they would carry colored margarine with them because the people in Minnesota wanted it, but it was forbidden by law. We've overcome those things. Margarine is much more popular now than butter. Soybeans in the Criscos and all the cooking oils in the world, so the soybean oil has been accepted. The proteins are in thousands of food, but only its functionality. All of these new seafood sticks you have, the crab, imitation crab sticks, imitation scallops and things, all use protein, soy protein for binders. So we're making progress. The oil is completely home-free, but the meal, the protein side, still has some way to go. Mm-hmm.
Well, you came along at the right time for people who were interested in health and in weight reduction, too much oil or butter and so on, so that you probably came at just the right time to take advantage of these interests.
Yes, we did, and it kind of also like the chicken egg a little bit, the fact that the products were available.
Yes.
All of these drinks that claim diet reduction mm-hmm. generally contain soy protein as well as, let's say, some non-fat dried milk. Mm-hmm. But it is recognized now, and we're pleased.
Well, did this interest in diet come first, or did your business interest, or did they just work together?
I think they worked together. We certainly tried to stimulate the interest, but we couldn't do it by ourselves, and thank goodness the diet grew to help us along.
Mm-hmm. We talked a little bit about Mr. Andreas. I think many people are very interested in his interest in the Soviet Union. How did that develop?
Started out when he was up in Minnesota and realized that we had a great big surplus pile of butter here in the U.S. that wouldn't sell anywhere in the world, and the Soviet Union had a shortage of fats and oils. He went over to the Soviet Union after ascertaining here what the prices would be and so forth to buy the butter, went over to the Soviet Union to see if he could get any interest in the Soviet Union purchasing butter. He got to the point where our support for butter made the butter price of the government stocks high price to the world price. So when he came back to approach the government about disposing of the surplus at underworld price, met great resistance, of course, in parts of Congress because that would have been feeding the Russians who were our enemies in 1952, et cetera, et cetera. And that never came about, but it was his first interest. Came back and he has told me several times that he felt, he learned then that the Russians were good business people, were honorable, and politics aside and so forth, as far as business to business goes, there were people you could talk to and trust, and a contract was a contract mm-hmm. and so forth. No contract came out of that one, but eventually we did some grain shipments and so forth that he was involved in mm-hmm. through his first Oceania company.
That was right after World War II, wasn't it, that he first became interested?
Yeah, 1952,
so
just shortly.
He must have found the conditions very interesting at that time. The country's perhaps still suffering from the effects of the war?
I think he knew then, yes, that we, the U.S., had a greater capacity to produce agricultural products than we had to consume. And so that we had to develop the export market. And after the days of the Marshall Plan were over, when the giveaways were over, we had to have an avenue to sell. Using the Marshall Plan as a vehicle was, you go in there and say, hey, the U.S. has been a supplier, you've been getting it, now you're back on your feet, you've got to start buying it. Mm-hmm. He was an early pioneer in making sure that the agricultural export market was developed to its potential.
That they followed up on
Correct.
The entry they had had
right.
through the market
because,
Marshall Plan.
Because if we didn't, the Australias
yes.
and Canadas and other
right.
producers, would jump in there and fill the void. And we had primed the pump through the Marshall Plan. Why not get a drink of the water now?
Well, of course. Well, when did you enter the firm, Mr. Burke? What was your background? Can't you tell us about your career?
Okay, yeah, I had, after service, joined Central Soya Company in the early 50s, who was one of the four processors mm-hmm. I mentioned before
yeah.
that was allied in this food study with bread, and was with them until 1969, just about the time that Duane came on the board of ADM in 1966. In 1970, it was already agreed he was going to be more active. His brother came aboard in 1968, Lowell Andreas, as president of the company. And I joined them in 69 when they were pulling together some people they had known in the industry to form the nucleus that would move down to Decatur.
Mm-hmm.
Some people came from Minneapolis. A lot of the people stayed in Minneapolis. They brought people in. Jim Randall came from Cargill. I came from Central Soya. Ray Fiedler came in from Decatur, from Staley over to ADM. Mm-hmm. So he pulled together a team of people he had known and
mm-hmm.
I hope respected. over the years and formed the new ADM management team here in Decatur in 69.
Did all of you have a farm background? Is that how you first became interested in this field?
Duane had a farm background. Jim Randall's from a small city in Wisconsin. Ray Fiedler, in fact, he was a Decatur boy. I was a small town Ohio boy, but we'd had experience in other ag processing industries. Mm-hmm. Now, my dad came off the farm and so forth, so all of that I know were no more than one generation removed mm-hmm. from the farm.
You certainly must have had some background or interest in agriculture
oh, yes.
to bring you into this field. Do you have a group of scientists that work for you, or how do you get your data?
Yeah, we have several labs. We do two things. We do some own basic research work here in Decatur, a lab out at Lakeview. We do basic research work at a lab in Clinton, Iowa, where a lot of our enzyme work goes, which is basic modification. Then we have applications labs, where we once we develop a product like our textured vegetable protein mm-hmm. or our isolate proteins or some of our fructose products, where these products are applied, how does it work in a sausage? How does it work in a baked mm-hmm. good? What can we do with sweeteners in ice cream, for example? One of the projects that our people put together was this all-vegetable ice cream, where instead of milk protein, we had soy protein. Instead of dairy fat, we had corn oil or soybean oil, but we had corn oil in this case. Instead of sugar, we had fructose. And then we used a soy product called lecithin, which is an emulsifier that's extracted from the oil, as the thing to hold it all together. So we had four of our products in this, and they're the cows and the sugar cane had no associate. It was an all-vegetable ice cream. This was shown to many people. Eventually, Tofutti came out with a commercial product, and now there are about four or five different companies making vegetable ice cream. So these things, we develop the products, and then we develop the applications for them. Then we have to go out and sell to the customers.
Do you hire the scientists out of college, or how do you get the people who are
We have gotten some right out of college. Generally, though, we found it's easier to raid and get somebody
who's had experience.
And not necessarily another company, but universities. A lot of these kids have worked as grad students for a while. Then we'll go pick them up.
Well, good. The public, at least in Decatur, is accustomed to thinking of ADM as soybean processors, but we're told that you're very big in peanuts, and we know you're into hydroponic farming. Will you tell us about these and any other enterprises you have?
Okay, just so you understand, not trying to be braggadocio, but one of the things we believe about from a business standpoint is you've got to have a significant market share of any business you're in order to be strong in that market. So we're in soy processing. We're the largest domestic soy processor in the U.S. We're very big in corn milling. We're the largest corn miller in the U.S. And from the corn milling, we get the fructose and the alcohol, so forth, dextrose products, etc. We are the second largest wheat flour miller in the U.S., although that's not too well known because you won't see any ADM packages on the shelves. We sell bulk trucks and bulk cars of wheat and some sacked wheat, 100-pound sacks, to the bakeries and the food companies. So we're not a retail supplier, but yet we're the second largest wheat miller, bigger than General Mills, bigger than Pillsbury, bigger than people whose products you see in the shelf, but who don't do the industrial flour business. We are the largest peanut processor in the U.S. We have a joint venture in that one with a co-op in Georgia, Gold Gist, and the two of us have over 25% of the peanuts processed in the United States. And we in turn sell them to the peanut butter companies and things, so you don't see our brand names, but you can't buy a jar of Skippy or Peter Pan or whatever you use, Jeff, you know, without knowing there's some ADM peanuts in there. We are a barley maltster for the brewing industry. We have recently become a rice miller where we mill rice. We're a cottonseed processor, the largest cottonseed processor in the U.S. We are still a flax producer, as I said. We refine sugar cane at a plant in Louisiana. We have feed mill division. And then to support all these processing activities, we have our own barge line that has over 1,400 barges. We own and operate over 8,000 rail cars and about 400 trucks. So all the transportation to do the business that we do.
It is big business, isn't it?
We're the largest agri-processor in the U.S. In 1987, here we were number 67th in Fortune's 500 list. We're probably the least known company that high because we don't have consumer products.
But it is a thrilling story.
It
is. I think that right here in Decatur we have this operation going on.
When we came to Decatur in 69, we were $300 million in sales and something like 435th on the Fortune list. We'll be over $7 billion in total sales here in 87, and we're up to 67th. And that's all happened in the years we've been in Decatur.
That's very, very good. Now, you may have touched upon this, but let's talk again about your special interests at ADM. What are you, yourself, specially interested in?
Well, all of us are trying to make sure that ADM stays a low-cost producer in the business so we stay viable there as far as the business side goes. I think most of us who have worked with Duane or known Duane for a long time share the interest that we have in trying to provide low-cost food to the U.S. isn't hungry, but we still want to be, we only use about 13% of our disposable income for food. And that fact, has always been good for the other businesses because the less people spend for food, the more they have to spend for clothing, cars, and things, which help keep the economy going because they will spend what they have left. The U.S. aren't great savers compared to the Japanese and so forth. At the same time, we'd like to be able to get some of this food into countries where they spend 40 to 50% of their money for food. The French, for example, who are quite sophisticated, still spend about 24% of their income for food. You get into the East Bloc countries, the Polands and the Czechoslovakias and so forth, they're spending upwards of 40% of their disposable income for food, which leaves little for the other luxuries or the would-be luxuries of life. Then you get into the developing nations, where you're spending in some cases over 50% just trying to exist for food and not having a lot of food anyway. We're trying to get a lot of food products through our proteins and our oils and things that will improve the standard of living throughout the world, which would be good for us. We're not being purely altruistic, but at the same time, it's a package that's good for everybody involved. We'd like to see that happen.
So you want to upgrade other countries at the same time that we are providing a market for the United States, but helping all of these other
Correct. The American farmer is as competitive as any farmer in the world. He can produce corn, wheat, beans as cheap as anybody in the world. And we think our processing companies are competitive. Therefore, we should be able to supply any country who needs food, as well as the Australians, the Canadians, the Brazilians, or the Argentinians, on a free market basis.
And at the same time, you are helping other nations improve their health and their general economy and so on.
Correct.
So that really is a very lofty purpose. How well is this succeeding?
We're doing pretty well. Our exports now, as a percent of total sales in the company, last year were 14%. So 14% of our total sales of products produced in the U.S. are going into the export market, largely to the developed markets, however. But there are some sales to lesser developed countries that we make through the government that aren't included in that figure. And that is to say that we will supply the government or sell to the government foods that they in turn donate under PL 480 that go to the, as used in Bangladesh and Kampuchea, those problems where they had feeding problems, they have it on a steady basis at UN relief camps in Haiti, Dominican Republic, over in India. The United States Agency for International Development, USAID, is active in many parts of the world with the kinds of foods that State Aid and ourselves and all make and put together and sell to them. Blended foods with a good protein calorie balance, etc. Now that business isn't including our 14%, but we're one of the three largest suppliers of those protein fortified foods to AID.
Mm-hmm. We see many stories of foreign visitors who come to Decatur. For example, Japanese were here recently, I believe, and people from Germany. Are these countries friendly in their attitudes, or do they feel that they are competitors, or what is their general attitude?
In some cases, there's a resentment that they're not self-sufficient, but at the same time, they couldn't sell us Mercedes if the Germans don't buy something from us. Uh-huh. Our farmers can be more efficient because our farms are larger and we have better soil and better climate. The old primogeniture succession that's been on in Europe for years has split the farms on up.
Mm-hmm.
Where our farms tend to stay in one group, they mm-hmm. take 40 acres and pretty soon split it down to 4 parts to 10 and then on down. Now they can't use big tractors and things, and they can't be as efficient as we are. Therefore, they do buy from us, although they have some tariff problems. We have tariff problems overcoming. But basically, they know that we're low-cost producers, our prices are good, and they can't sell us Mercedes if they don't buy soybean meal.
Mm-hmm.
Japanese are somewhat the same way. You talked about investors. We were over in Tokyo just last month in May. We're going to list ADM on the Tokyo Stock mm-hmm. Exchange and try and get some of those yen and dollar back, have them buy ADM stock. They are good customers for processed products mm-hmm. and grains right now.
We heard a rumor of a tax that might be imposed by the European Economic Community. Is that going to go through?
Veg oil tax. I doubt it because it, not to say it won't, but it is on all oil products, not just imported U.S. soybean oil. It would be on oils produced in France from domestic crops such as their rapeseed. And sunflower crops. The interesting part about this tax is what they're trying to do is butter has been subsidized at a high price, and butter is a high cost item. They're trying to get the lower priced vegetable oils up closer to butter price, hoping the consumers will buy more butter, therefore meaning there is less for them to put in storage. But what it will do, of course, is put higher food costs to the European consumer. Therefore, I don't think the whole thing will mm-hmm. go through. The consumers won't take higher costs just to protect a few local farmers.
So there will be a problem in trying to convince their people and the other countries in the European community to go along.
I think so, but you have to recognize that the Europeans are much tougher traders, that is to say the bureaucrats are, than our bureaucrats in Washington are. And they use these things as threats against the Europeans, or against the Americans, and quite often Washington doesn't understand what a true threat is from a veiled threat, mm-hmm. from a smokescreen. And I think business people have better understanding of that than our bureaucrats do.
You must have people in your firm who do a great deal of travel, yourself and others too. Isn't that true, that you are keeping very close touch with other countries?
True, you can't do business, you know, without being over there. We do have sales offices in Tokyo, in the UK, in Rotterdam, and in Hamburg that are staffed by ADM employees. Then we have an association with Alfred C. Tepfer, which is an international trading company. We own a minority interest in that. Ourselves and the co-ops are the owners of that company. They have offices in 36 countries. I'm sorry, they have 36 offices in 24 countries. Then we have people traveling out of the U.S., and there isn't a week that somebody from Decatur isn't overseas somewhere and flying all over the country as far as trying to sell oils or proteins or flour products coast to coast, border to border.
course, we know that our balance of trade isn't good and that we do need to develop these contacts with other countries. Do you have any suggestions for dealing with other countries in a business way?
You know, nothing that I, if Washington can't solve a problem, I don't think ADM can. The one thing we would say, and I mentioned it before, is we feel the U.S. is competitive in the agricultural business, that God blessed us with good soil, good climate, good rainfall patterns, and so forth. And as an example, the PRC, mainland China, is on about the same latitude we are. And they have about as much arable land as we do in total acreage as this, but they only average half the rainfall. Then you've got the Russians trying to feed 300 million people mm-hmm. on land that's situated so far north that there's not enough daylight to grow a lot of mm-hmm. things. So we're blessed here in that we've got, between the Alleghenies and the Rockies, we've got all this good prairie farmland, rich in soil, blessed with rainfall and so forth. So, and we have an intelligence system of University of Illinois, Nebraska, the old land-grant college system, mm-hmm. where our farmers have been educated for over a century now. In 1862 mm-hmm. they opened up. So our production is good. Our handling is good, and our processing is good. We can be competitive. If we can get out into the free market, yeah, we can do a great job at Green Overseas. We just have to keep going and push because other people are trying to do the same thing. Mm-hmm.
But you do think that there is a future for
I think there's a future. The only thing I wanted to say was, you know, it's not that we're smarter than the rest of people mm-hmm. in the world. You've got to recognize that we've got some gifts. And mm-hmm. if you don't take advantage of them and utilize them, maybe you lose them. That's, you know, if we don't watch our soil, maybe we'll lose it. But as I said, we've got all this great soil and capabilities to produce mm-hmm. things. Let's take advantage of it and use it.
And you are not only interested in the money aspect, but you do have the idea, for example, feeding the hungry in the world and promoting goodwill among nations. That is certainly to your credit.
Every president that Duane has worked with, from Eisenhower forward, has always said, you know, I think, talked about the Russian trade, for example, I think we should try and sell agricultural products to the Russians. If we're their breadbasket, you know, they're less inclined to ever start sending missiles or things over. And everyone knows that the people who are hungry are agitated more easily. People who are well-fed aren't as anxious to go out and do things, you know, they're happier with their home lives and so forth. It's the hungry, and that's been true in every revolution, mm-hmm. and the deprived who go out and do things. I think if you can feed the world better, that you're going to have a better place for all of us to mm-hmm. live.
And people will get along
right.
much better
mm-hmm.
in that way. Well, do you have any other comments on the future of ADM or the field in general?
We doubled in our productive capacity, our ability to process grains, doubled our size from 1980 to the current level here in 1987. We intend to keep on growing. I don't know if we can double again in another 7 years, but maybe by the end of the century, we'll be doubled again. I think we should be. And we should still be in Decatur mm-hmm. and with higher employment levels and greater office staffs, maybe working on a larger global basis. We think we could continue to grow, and we continue to grow here in Decatur.
Well, we certainly wish you well in all of these endeavors, and it is certainly the benefit of Decatur and the United States to have firms of the area of the background and area and the goals of ADM, and men like Mr. Andreas and yourself working to bring these goals forward. We thank you very much for helping us in this project, Mr. Burkett.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thank you. You have been listening to the reminiscences and the observations of Mr. R.E. Burkett, who is speaking and telling us the story of ADM. This is Betty Trunell speaking for the Decatur Public Library.